Does everyone here know who William H. Gates III is? It is Bill Gates. So do you know who Bill Gates is? Give me like a yes or a no. Mostly yes, it's great. So he's a pretty special guy. You might not think he's as cool as Steve Jobs, but he's done some amazing things in his life. He's the founder of Microsoft, which revolutionized the computing world. He almost single-handedly sparked the era of the personal computer. Many of you might not remember, but there was a time when there was no such thing as a personal computer. So no personal computer means no internet, which means no YouTube, no Facebook, no Insta. So without this guy, there's none of that. So you can thank him for all of that sort of stuff. I'm not sure what he's worth now, but his net worth was over $100 billion, his personal net worth. He was the richest man in the world by the age of 39 for 7 years straight. And just 2 years ago, he was the recipient of the Presidential Medal of Freedom, which is the highest honour an American civilian can have. And then, on top of that, he seems to be a really nice guy. So he established the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which has an endowment of over $50 billion. And they use that money to enhance global health care and to reduce extreme poverty. So this guy, who's maybe not as cool as Steve Jobs, is very, very successful, much more successful than me. But what makes him so special? Give me some answers. How did he become Bill Gates?
He likes Windows.
He likes Windows, nice pun.
Smart guy.
Smart guy, yep. Like big brains, maybe a maths whiz, business skills maybe, strong work ethic.
Creative,
someone said, creative. So I don't know if you've heard of this guy, Malcolm Gladwell. He's written a book called Outliers, which you probably have heard of. And an oversimplification of his theory in the book is that Bill Gates was just born for it. He was born in 1955, which was the perfect year to revolutionise home computing. Because in around 1975, computers shrunk to the size and to the price that a geek could afford to buy personally. Bill Gates was any older, he'd probably already have a job in IBM, probably have a family and kids, and not be willing to risk all that to start Microsoft. If he was any younger, he'd be in high school. And either of those options would have led to him missing the revolution. Throw on top of that, he happened to be born into a rich family that could send him to a fancy private school that in year eight gave him access to computing that people in universities didn't even have. Add to that, he happened to meet a parent who worked for a computing company and needed someone to test software on the weekends, and that was Bill Gates. Add to that, he lived in walking distance from a university that had free computing available at night, and then throw on top of that a few more random coincidences and move forward 50 years and you have Bill Gates the billionaire, one of the most successful people in the world. Sure, he had to be smart and driven, all that sort of stuff, but Malcolm Gladwell suggests that really he had to be born in the right place at the right time. 2 years later, he's not Bill Gates. 2 years earlier, he's not Bill Gates. Born in China, he's not Bill Gates. So he was born to be something special, to be someone special. In comparison, you can look at me. Born in Australia, 1985, not very rich, not very smart, went to a public high school, revolutionised nothing, and you can conclude that I'm nothing special. You might look back at your own achievements and maybe think through those things and maybe, hey, think you're not that something special. But today's passage, if we can make it through the complicated bits, claims that actually you're born a very special person. If you're a Christian here, you're born a very special person. So as we work our way through this argument, hopefully you'll be encouraged and convinced by what Paul says. So, verse 21, Paul opens this pretty sarcastically to these teachers of the law. He says to them, "Do you even know the law?" We've been going through Galatians in little chunks because Paul gives us a really dense argument in this book. In this section, this is like the end of his main argument, and then he moves on to some other stuff after this. So a quick summary of the relevant stuff you need to know for this section. Chapters 1 and 2, the churches in Galatia heard and accepted the gospel. So they heard that Jesus is the only way to be justified, which means Jesus is the only right way to know God. And they said, yes, that's true, we accept that. But at some point, among them were people called Judaizers, which were telling them that, no, you had to also follow the law of Moses. So Jesus plus the law of Moses. That's how you'd be right with God. And the law of Moses is basically all the laws in the Old Testament. So that's who Paul is talking to sarcastically. And he talks to them sarcastically because in chapters 3 and 4, he tells them the law was good, but now it's irrelevant. The law was good, but it never brought life. That was never its real purpose. It was only here temporarily as a guardian. And then once the children who it was guardian over grew up, that's like the Israelites, it's no longer needed. He describes its guardianship like slavery. So they were in slavery, but now they're grown, so they don't need to be in slavery anymore. And he goes on now to argue it based on two stories from the Old Testament. So that's background. That's kind of what you need to know in your head to kind of follow what's going on. So verses 22 and 23. Story one. The story of Hagar and Sarah. It's told in different parts of Genesis. If you're not familiar with the story, God promises to bless Abraham in all sorts of ways, that he'll have lots of children is probably the most important one, a whole nation of them. Fast forward about 10 years, and Abraham still has no children. And his wife Sarah, on top of that, appears to be barren. I think she was about 90 years old at that point, so barren and pretty old to have children. So it seems like God's not coming through on his promises. So what Sarah says is, why don't you marry my slave Hagar and have a child with her? Abraham thinks about it and says, yep, does that, and a child's born. Right now you might be tripping out at that story. Yes, it is weird, and no, probably it's not the right thing to marry your wife's slave and have a child with her. But it happened. And after that happened, God did then give him a child through Sarah. So even though Sarah was old and barren, she too had a child. So this is what Paul means when he writes verses 21 to 23, that there were two children, one of the flesh and one of the promise. Hagar's son came by normal means, the fleshly means. That is, she was probably younger and she was fertile. So having a child with her is normal. But Sarah's son came by promise because Sarah was old, like very old, and she was barren. So having a child with her is not normal. Having a child with her only comes through a promise. So there's the child of the flesh and the child of the promise. So what's the point of telling you this story? Paul tells us in verse 24 it's an allegory. So he's using it figuratively. So the meaning of the original story is not necessarily the same as what he's describing now. So the original story isn't about this stuff, but he's using it to explain this stuff. He's taking well-known events, especially to the Galatians, and he's using it as a pattern or a picture to help describe something else. So it's an allegory. He says now, this is the allegory, Hagar represents Mount Sinai and Jerusalem. Mount Sinai is where Moses first got the laws of the Old Testament, and Jerusalem is where the temple was located, which is what you needed to carry out all those laws. So Hagar represents everything to do with obedience to the law, to the Old Testament. So in verse 25, where he says she's in slavery with her children and that she is Jerusalem, and those children who are hers are born into slavery to the law, he means that just like Hagar was a slave and she gave birth to a child who was a slave, the Jews who are in Jerusalem now, they're children of Jerusalem and they're in slavery because Jerusalem is in slavery. On the other hand, there's a Jerusalem which is above, which is like Sarah, and her children are born to be free. And then he proves it by telling you another story, story two. So this is the prophecy from Isaiah 54. Be glad, barren woman, you who never bore a child, shout for joy and cry aloud. You who are never in labour, because more are the children of the desolate woman than of her who has a husband. The barren woman in this prophecy isn't Sarah. It's actually the city of Jerusalem, which is confusing because there was like another city. So forget that city. This is like Jerusalem, but in a different way. So it seems like in the time of the prophecy, the nation of Israel, the city of Jerusalem, had been destroyed because of their sin. So God sent the Babylonians to wipe it out. and in that process, they destroyed the temple. And the temple was the center of Jewish life. Without the temple, there's no access to God. So that's why Jews, even today, will go to the Western Wall or the Wailing Wall. I don't know if you've heard of that. Nods for if you've heard of the Wailing Wall. Yeah, some people. So it's this wall in Jerusalem where it's kind of the final remaining wall of the second temple. Jews will go there because they think that that's as close as they can get to the temple, and therefore that's as close as they can get to God. So they'll go up to this wall, put their hands on it, write prayers and slide it into the wall because that's as close as they can ever get to God. This one remaining wall of a very old temple. So in the time of story 2, Isaiah 54, the temple was destroyed. Later on, it was rebuilt. So when you hear of Jesus in the temple, it's Jesus in the second temple. So first temple destroyed, rebuilt. Second temple, where Jesus is, destroyed again, AD 70, by the Romans. And then today, where the Wailing Wall is the remnants of that temple. That's where all the Jews go now to pray to God, to come near to him. Anyway, all of that is to say that Jerusalem was destroyed because of sin, and because there's no Jerusalem and no temple, there's no fleshly, no earthly way to access God. But it's from this Jerusalem, the one that's been destroyed, that children are born into freedom. The destroyed Jerusalem leads to children in freedom. Barren Jerusalem gives birth to free children, like barren Sarah gives birth to free children. Can you see the analogy taking shape? So that's all to say it's not by human effort, but by God's effort that people come near to God now. So just before this quote, there's chapter 53 of Isaiah, where we hear about a man called the suffering servant. So that man suffered and was crushed for the sins of God's people so that they could be restored, so that the barren city in chapter 54 could give birth to free children. So it wasn't just because of time or chance that a barren city gives birth to many children. It's because God works through a suffering servant. All right, so that's like halfway through. So I'll give you a summary. I think we need a summary. Hagar is fertile, but she's a slave. Her children are born the normal way, and they're born into slavery. She is just like the Jerusalem that you see today, the one with the temple in Paul's day, the one with just the wall that we have now in our day, because that Jerusalem works by fleshly means, by normal means. You use your own effort to come near to God. If you follow that Jerusalem, if you're born by that Jerusalem, you are born a slave. Sarah is barren, but she's free. Her children can only be born by God's effort. And her children are born free. She is like the Jerusalem that we can't see, the Jerusalem that's above. Jerusalem that was destroyed and that is barren. Because the children of that Jerusalem come only by God's effort. The one with no temple because it was destroyed produces free children. So anyone still following? Yeah? Okay, good. Here's where hopefully it starts to make sense. I think that was the hard part. So here's hopefully where it makes sense. Verse 28. Now you, brothers and sisters, like Isaac, are children of the promise. So Paul knows, and we know, that this suffering servant that I've been talking about is Jesus paying for the sin of God's people, and that the children of barren Jerusalem are the Galatian church. And the children of that barren Jerusalem is you. You are born free. Bill Gates was born to be a millionaire. His whole life was set up to make him a millionaire. No one else could have done it, only Bill Gates. But you were born to be something much more special. You were born to be free. Whatever circumstances you have in your growing up, they might be humble or they might be special. They were, in fact, very special. Because that, your birth, and a million other coincidences have led to you becoming a Christian. Or have led to you sitting in this room, hearing a call to become a Christian, hearing a call to become free. So if you've become a Christian, on that day, you were born by this ruined Jerusalem, you were born by this barren Sarah into freedom. So in verses 29 to 30, he goes back to story one and he pulls the analogy further. And this is where it really starts to hit our reality. The interaction of the children of Hagar and Sarah are a pattern for how the Galatians and the Judaizers, the people that were telling them add the law, should interact. By extension, it's how we Christians and people who try and tell us to abandon the gospel should interact as well. So verse 30, just like the free child was persecuted by the slave child, the Christians at that time were persecuted by the Judaizers. How are they to respond? It might surprise you a little, but they're actually to respond pretty harshly. So normally the message we hear is, love your enemies, pray for those who persecute you, which is true. But when it comes to slavery and freedom, Paul says, be severe and protect your freedom. The Judaizers told the Galatians that Christ wasn't enough. And then Paul, in this letter, proves that Christ is all you need, even from the Old Testament, which they were wanting you to obey. Even the Old Testament tells you that Christ is enough. The promise alone is enough. You don't need the law. The new covenant is enough. You don't need the old covenant. So they assessed the Judaizers' claim and they said, no, it's not real. So then Paul says, cast them out. Again, this is an allegory from story one. The meaning of when Sarah cast out Hagar is like different. But what Paul means to show is that you don't mix law and promise. You don't mix old covenant and new covenant. You don't mix Jesus and Moses. They all stand separate. If you're with Jesus, you're with Jesus only. If you're a slave, you're a slave. If you're free, you're free. And you, all of you, are free, is what he's saying. So verse 31, if you're born to be free, and you are, then cast out slavery. Stand firm in what you know is true. And so the final verse, Galatians 5:1, is where Paul really reveals what he's talking about, I think. The whole Hagar and Sarah thing is really about Christ. Like God was the one that gave Sarah free children, it was Christ, the suffering servant, that gave Jerusalem, the Jerusalem above, free children, which is the Galatians, which is you. So why were the Galatians tempted by slavery if they were free? They weren't dumb. There was something attractive about Judaism. There was something that looked like freedom to them. Jews now aren't dumb. There's something attractive about modern-day Judaism. It's tangible, it's visible, you can do something, it's present, there's a wall. But freedom in Christ, there's nothing that you can see or touch. The Galatians were tempted. But it's for freedom that Christ has set us free, so Paul tells us to resist. And clearly we're not very enticed by going back to the works of the law or converting to Judaism or anything. Although there might be some Christians who are maybe ethnic Jews or something like that, that might be tempted by actually going back to the actual law of Moses. That's probably not our temptation though. I think we're drawn to other laws that can seem like they're freedom and they can seem like they're so right. I think in our modern Australian context, there's two issues that really do this to us now, and they're both really controversial. Homosexuality, which is increasingly tied to the transgender rights movement, and the issue of abortion. So I'm not talking about these because they're hobby horses or because they're the most important things for Christians to talk about. And they're certainly not popular. Like what I say now is probably rejected by 99% of Australians. They're not hobby horses that we need to talk about all the time. They're really not. And actually in this church, I don't think we talk about it that much, really. Occasionally we do. But they're big issues in society which Christians need to wrestle with. I'm not going to go into detail about why we think homosexuality and abortion are not biblical stances. Steve's done some sermons on that in the past. And if you'd like to talk about it, we can talk about it after the sermon. I just want to make it clear that we don't think homosexuality or abortion are Christian points of view. And that's not to say that homosexual people or people who have had abortions aren't welcome here in our church. That's far from the case. God's church and this church right here welcomes everyone. But our standard for freedom of what we believe is right and wrong is set by God, and that's what Paul calls us to hold on to. Everyone falls short here in different ways, maybe including these two, homosexuality and abortion. But that's why we're here. We're here because we've been forgiven, or we're here because we're seeking forgiveness. And that's available to everyone. So anyway, all of that is caveats to what I want to say. So that's just kind of justifying what I want to say. The reason I bring up the two issues is because they're mega tense issues in our day. And the position of Australian society on these issues looks like freedom. Homosexuality is okay. Abortion is okay. They're your choice. You're free. Do what you want. And Christianity's view on them looks like slavery. No, you can't practice homosexuality. No, you can't practice abortion. So the temptation towards accepting these things is strong. And that's the type of temptation that we need to resist. Because it tells us that the gospel is good, but you need this as well. You need the gospel, plus you need to accept these things. And then you're good. Especially this temptation is strong for younger kids, probably like high school age, maybe even early uni. Because they've grown up in a world where this has always been okay. That's the only message they've heard. I've helped at a couple of youth groups in the past few years, and this is the issue that stops the most kids from accepting Christianity. Why can't they do it? Why can't they be homosexual? Why can't they accept homosexuality? Why can't they have abortions? Why does God restrict it? There's no real answers that I can give you. Like, God doesn't exactly tell us a why. He just tells us that his way is better and his way is freedom. And that's why it's so hard to accept. Like, we just don't have that answer that might make a lot of sense to us. And so Australian society's view looks like freedom. It looks pretty good. So there's a real temptation of going into slavery. A different temptation than the Galatians, but a very real temptation still. Because it seems like freedom. You're not dumb. It does look like freedom. It really does. And that's where the final verse of this passage meets reality. It's for freedom that Christ has set you free. Therefore stand firm. Do not again be entangled to the yoke of slavery. Slavery, it tells us, can actually be tempting. Like, it can look good to want to be a slave. And that's why there's a warning. Counterintuitively, the yoke of slavery often looks good. Maybe those two big issues in society aren't big issues in your circles. Maybe for you it's different in your circles. Maybe it's the love of money. Maybe it's gambling too much. Maybe it's drinking too much. Maybe it's different sexual sins. There's a million things that might tempt you, and there's a million things that tempt me, and they all look good, like really good, genuinely good. And it might seem like it's freedom because it's the only way you know. Maybe it's the reward of having them. Maybe it's the reward of acceptance in society. But that isn't freedom. You're free now. This freedom can't be earned or worked. It comes from God. It comes from Jesus. So don't be yoked to that slavery. Sometimes you might pick up that yoke again, but throw it off because you're free.